case is 72805, McMurray versus State. Once council have gotten themselves in a position where they can go forward, we'll begin.
I reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor, for rebuttal.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much. May it please the court, William Brown, on behalf of appellant Pasquale McMurray. The court should vacate Mr. McMurray's conviction and order a new trial because his conviction was tainted by constitutional error that cannot be proven harmless. Granting Mr. McMurray a new trial is the appropriate starting point for clarifying Brady jurisprudence in Nevada because the issue presented in this case, which is the duty of inquiry imposed by Kyles, is where Brady begins. This case is before the court because the state indicated before trial that it would not comply with its duty of inquiry under Kyles to learn of exculpatory evidence in law enforcement's possession. And the district court agreed that the state was not required to. When Mr. McMurray requested that the state learn of favorable evidence in law enforcement's possession, the state said, I mean, what am I supposed to do? Call every police officer at Metro and say, hey, have you ever met Pasquale McMurray? Do you have any exculpatory information about him? And the district court ruled the state is not required to go out and seek information within. Nothing requires the state to go out and make those types of requests. But that is exactly what Kyle says a prosecutor must do to comply with Brady. And so when the district court excused the prosecutor from learning of favorable evidence, the district court excused the prosecutor from complying with Brady.
Why shouldn't the defendant have to make some showing of materiality consistent, say, with Sonner? Some theory other than just a broad fishing expedition going through it. Like, here's a defense. Here's the type of information I'm looking for.
Sure. Sonner, to begin, is legally distinct. Sonner involved the death of a highway patrolman. The defense attorney was asking for full disclosure of a victim's personnel files with the stated purpose of hoping to decrease somehow the life or the value of the surface of this victim.
But in Sonner, they touched upon materiality a bit in that if there had been, there's at least a suggestion, if there had been some other evidence that perhaps the officer was the first aggressor or some other something else tethered to the facts of the case or some showing that the result in Sonner might have been different. So why not here?
Well, I think because Sonner, number one, Sonner deals with a defense request for the disclosure of personnel files. It does not deal with a prosecutor's duty to learn of exculpatory evidence. That's what this case is about. This case is not about suppression of Brady material. It's about a prosecutor's obligation to learn of Brady material in the first place. I think the state concedes by sending truthfulness requests to Metro that it has some sort of a duty, some sort of an obligation to find out if there is exculpatory or impeachment material in personnel files. Why else would they do it? So I think the state admits that they have some duty to learn of exculpatory information, whether that's in a personnel file or in a detective's rough notes.
Well, that's tethered, though, to the case, because if they're going to call them as a witness and their credibility is an issue, they make a truthfulness inquiry. But you're suggesting a much broader inquiry with no showing, right?
Well, what I'm saying is that Kyles plainly says that a prosecutor has a duty to learn the favorable evidence in law enforcement's possession. Kyles does not say that when a defendant can show, can make an initial materiality showing, that triggers a prosecutor's duty to learn of exculpatory evidence. The prosecutor's duty to inquire is freestanding. It exists regardless of what defense or what requests are made by the state. It exists by virtue of the prosecutor's role as a seeker of truth and a seeker of justice, not just a litigant. I mean, Kyles was decided in 1995, but its foundational premise was announced in the 1930s in Berger, where the United States Supreme Court said the United States attorney is not just an average litigant. He's not just a lawyer representing a party. He represents a sovereign. He represents the government, whose duty is to govern impartially and whose duty in the context of a criminal trial is to seek truth and seek justice, not just a conviction. So I think Sonner can't be read to somehow graft onto Kyle's a duty on the behalf of the defendant of making an initial showing of materiality before the prosecutor's duty to learn of exculpatory evidence is triggered. Is that sufficiently responsive?
Sure.
The harm...
Brown, could you clarify something for me? I know this was argued to the panel and it's been briefed before and it was supplemental briefing. I'm trying to clarify something, though. My understanding of the litigation in the district court before the district court judge is that McMurray made a request that the prosecution essentially inquire about the truthfulness of the officers involved without stating any reason for that inquiry. Is that accurate?
The defense request was very specific and essentially traced the contours of Giglio. The specific language of the, and you're asking just about the request of information and personnel files?
That's correct. That's what I understood the dispute was about. And certainly it's the reason we're now looking at this case en banc. So
sure.
My understanding of the request that was submitted was, I want, well, forget my understanding. You tell me what your understanding is. And I'm looking at what I understand McMurray specifically requested, which begins with disclosure of personnel files of all law enforcement witnesses whom it intends to call at trial, which reveals evidence of any acts of dishonesty, perjury, or any information that could cast doubt upon their credibility, including but not limited to records pertaining to disciplinary or internal affairs investigations, and there's a cite to Henthorne.
Correct.
And in reading the rest of the request, I don't see any predicate reason established for the request. Was there any?
Short answer, no. There wasn't.
So the case that's in front of us, the issue that's in front of us, is whether the prosecution, and based on the supplemental briefs, law enforcement, have an independent disclosure duty as part of discovery to identify truthfulness questions concerning investigative officers. Is that a fair statement of the issue?
I would say it is a fair statement, but it does not completely describe the issue. I would describe the issue this way. There is one main issue here, and that is whether a prosecutor has a duty to learn of favorable information in law enforcement's possession. There is a sub-issue as to whether that duty extends to impeachment information within personnel files. So you are correct.
Go ahead. I'll let you finish.
You're exactly right. You quote the exact language of the defense request that was made vis-a-vis personnel files. And that is part of this case. But again, that's a sub-issue. The greater issue is the prosecutor's duty under Kyle's to learn of exculpatory information in general. Subsumed within that greater duty to inquire and learn of favorable defense information would be favorable information that exists in the personnel files. I don't think Giglio, I think, plainly says that the prosecution has an obligation to turn over impeachment material. And I think if impeachment material happens to reside in personnel files, that information must still be disclosed.
So what is the rule? If we were to do an opinion in this case, what's the rule you want this court to enunciate, and under what constitutional provision?
I want the court to make a very limited ruling. I don't want the court to get into the mechanics of how prosecutors comply with Brady.
So you agree with Jennings?
I agree to the extent that there's a separation of powers issue, and courts should not be in the position of dictating to prosecutors exactly how they comply with their constitutional duties. I'm asking for something much more basic and much more fundamental. I'm asking for this court to say that Kyle's duty of inquiry applies to a prosecutor in a Nevada courtroom, and that a Nevada judge cannot excuse a prosecutor from her duty of affirmatively seeking to learn of exculpatory material in law enforcement's possession. I'm asking, in effect, that this court simply affirm that Kyle's means what it says, and that we will have trials in this state where a prosecutor seeks the truth by seeking to learn of exculpatory information before the trial begins. So I'm not asking for a very detailed, analysis or step-by-step procedure for prosecutors to comply with their duties. I'm simply asking for an affirmation that they have such a duty, and that this duty is inextricably tied to the due process right to a fair trial, and that when a district court judge says you don't have to look for exculpatory evidence, that the resulting trial cannot be fair, because we don't know what a prosecutor might have found.
So how do you square that rule you're requesting with Weatherford?
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the
difference. There's no general constitutional right to discovery in a criminal case.
Well, I agree there's no procedural right to discovery, but there is unquestionably...
I'm trying to find out what the rule you're requesting is tethered to. Is it tethered to the United States Constitution, which the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't seem to endorse? Is it tethered to the Nevada Constitution, and if so, what provision? Is it tethered to the discovery rule, of which I'm not familiar? You seem to tether it to Brady, but Brady is an analysis that's done post-conviction. The three elements of Brady, we wouldn't even get to materiality because we don't even know what we're materially assessing. So what is it tethered to?
It's tethered to the Due Process Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and it's tethered to Brady's recognition, and specifically Strickler, which says that to comply with Brady, a prosecutor must learn of exculpatory information in law enforcement's possession. And the Supreme Court has gone on to say that Brady protects due process. And if a district...
You're limiting the elements of Brady. There's three elements, one of which is materiality, and we never know about materiality till post-conviction time.
That's exactly right. And that is a Brady suppression analysis. That has to do with suppressed evidence that is discovered after the trial. We're talking about the antecedent duty, the catalyst that triggers the disclosure duty, which is the duty of a prosecutor to learn about evidence in the first place. So I think the materiality and prejudice is misplaced.
All right, one more factual question about the record.
Sure.
Did the state say in response to your motion, we refuse to look or we have no duty to look, and we haven't looked?
The state did not address that issue in its written briefing, and the only thing it said at the hearing is this. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Call every police officer at Metro and say, hey, have you ever met Pasquale McMurray? Do you have any exculpatory information about him? That was the extent of the state's substantive response to the request that they learn of favorable information.
Well, but that's not strictly true. At the transcript 105, the state says we submitted a request to the department for any truthfulness violations that have been sustained. And that is what they are entitled to. If a truthfulness violation has been sustained, then absolutely the defense is entitled to it. If not, they're not. And so in this case, factually, the crime was a fait accompli before the police ever got involved in any way, shape, or form. And so the issue was the veracity, are the officers who may call to testify to the statements the defendant gave truthful? And so I'm troubled by how you tether this duty that you want us to announce to anything in this case.
That was the state's response to the defense's request for exculpatory information in personnel files. That was not the state's response to the defense request that the prosecution learn of favorable evidence in law enforcement's possession.
Right, but this is its... I'm not sure what in this case is the springboard for why you say that duty should arise.
Well, Kyle plainly says that a prosecutor has a duty to learn of favorable evidence in law enforcement's possession. That's all that the defense asked that the prosecution do, is determine if Metro had any exculpatory or impeachment information. And the discussion of this begins on...
And are you asking us to enforce the entire request for production that you made in your motion to compel? In other words, I mean, it's not just personnel files. It is quite a few different... At AA 72 through 75...
Respond to the question.
That request is not a request for full disclosure of personnel files. It's a request that the state disclose information in personnel files to the extent that it relates to their credibility. So it was not a request for full sale disclosure. It was a request that the prosecutor look at the personnel files and determine if there was anything that might qualify, for example, as Giglio impeachment material, that that information be disclosed.
Thank you.
Any additional questions?
Counsel, we chewed up your time. We will give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Appreciate it.
On behalf of the state.
My name is Colleen Baharov, and I represent the respondent, the state of Nevada, in today's proceedings. I was also one of the trial counsel that handled the case below, and this case was my case from its inception in our office in March of 2014. Justice Pickering and Justice Hardesty, I want to start with the questions you asked counsel. Where in the record does the state say it's not going to follow the law? And I, Justice Pickering, you pointed out one area in the record where the state indicated that it would run its truthfulness violations, but the state also indicated in its written opposition to the motion to compel that the state understood the law and would comply with it. That's at page 89 of appellate appendix. On page 92, the state indicates that it wasn't aware of any judicial determinations with regards to any constitutional violations of the officers. The state indicated that we were under no obligation to accommodate a defendant's desire to flail about in a fishing expedition, but again, understood our requirements under Brady and under Giglio. On page 93 of appellant's appendix, the state indicated it would comply with its requirement and standard practice of conducting a Brady check through the LVMPD, and if anything was uncovered, the state would provide that information to the court to determine whether or not it is required to be turned over. At the time Ms. Luzaich came onto this case, the trial had been set previously 2 years prior with different co-counsel. At the time of this case before Judge Delaney on October 5th, 2016, Lisa Luzaich herself indicated that we would run a truthfulness check. There's no indication in the record that we failed to do this. And in fact, we cited in our written opposition and the court acknowledged in the hearing on October 5th that that is something that we do. And we did. We did it twice, in fact, in this case.
Ms. Baharov?
Yes.
Who determines what's Brady in the file? So you say we run a Brady check. So how does that work? You get the file and you look if there's Brady, or you call and you say, hey, officer, is there Brady? How does that work?
How we handle it is we send a Brady request through the LVMPD. They have a database, as they indicated in their brief, that includes those truthfulness violations, and not just violations that are still physically in those files, but any violations that occurred during the tenure of that officer's stay on the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. If there is anything in there that relates to the credibility for truthfulness, that information is provided to the state. The state is then tasked with providing that information to the court if the state is going to call that witness. That's in our policies and procedures, and in fact, we have done that in other cases. That wasn't at issue in this case, as we've received negative results.
Is that what you call the truthfulness inquiry?
Yes. Yes, Justice Pickering. That's what we call the truthfulness inquiry. What's also important to see here is in the record, in the written opposition to the motion below, which I personally authored, you can see that before the first trial setting, July of 2014, the state had provided all of the statements requested by the defense, any interviews requested by the defense, any video of the defendant's interview requested by the defense, anything inconsistent requested by the defense, and indicated if any additional items came up during the course of preparation for trial, the state would provide that. My understanding of Nevada law is I have a continuing duty to disclose any information that arises that was obviously requested, but also that could be termed exculpatory. And the state indicated in its written opposition that, of course, we would comply with those requirements.
Ms. Bobrov?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
In this instance, it was a truthfulness inquiry. But you agree that different factual circumstances might mean that exculpatory information may be broader than truthfulness. Could be excessive force, could be other issues that are in the...
I do agree with that. And I believe it was, you also requested this information, but Justice Hardesty addressed the court indicating that it wanted a more specific factual predicate. That's where that specific factual predicate is helpful to the court in determining materiality. That's why they ask for specific factual predicates so that the court and, of course, the state can look for additional information, of course, over and above truthfulness and provide that. But what I would like to point out for your honors is that in this particular case, there were no allegations of misogyny. There were no allegations of bias. There were no allegations that there was an excessive use of force by any of the officers in this case. And I would like to remind all of you that we never provided statements of the defendant on purpose. We didn't elicit that through the detective in this case. But even if we had, that entire interview was on videotape and available to the defense and, of course, could have been used to impeach or in other ways try to diminish the helpfulness of that for the state.
Well, it sounds like the Clark County has its own policies, kind of an office procedures. Every other county in the state probably has its own procedures on how these things work.
Sure.
If we were to determine what's appropriate for everybody to discharge their duties, what position would you take on that?
I would take the position that this court cited in Roberts, that the state has a continuing obligation to look for Brady material. The state is required to look for that information and provide it to the defense. I would ask that this court follow Roberts in holding that if there's not a specific request, the standard of review, of course, is different. If it's perjurious, of course, the standard of review is much stricter. If there is a general request, of course, we're talking about a different standard of review. I think that's the appropriate way. But I also think, as I believe the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department stated, prosecutors cannot be tasked with personally going over to their individual law enforcement offices and looking through those files. For example, as they indicated, the math wouldn't be hard to do. If a prosecutor has 30 cases on for trial and anywhere from 2 to 5 witnesses work for the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, that's 60 officers plus that attorney is required to go over and look through the files of, assuming, of course, that all those witnesses are different. There is some overlap. There would have to be a dedicated system in place, a dedicated prosecutor, a dedicated person at Metro to sit there and look through files all day to see what's going on. The way it works right now is we send that inquiry over to the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. They inform us if there is any issues, and we provide that information to the court. That policy and that process has worked. There's no indication it did not work in this case, and in fact, there is no evidence that has been provided to your honors that shows that it wasn't turned over. So really what we're having right now is an academic exercise with regards to Brady and a Brady violation. And it's kind of hard to look at the record in this case and see where that would be helpful. But what I can explain is that that process has worked in my cases in the past. That process worked in this case twice. There's no indication that there's anything that I wasn't provided that I did not provide before July of 2014. I urge your honors to follow the three-pronged test of Brady. I think that that's important and appropriate. Of course, we need evidence, first of all, that was not turned over, and there isn't any in this case that they can point to. Of course, we need a showing of materiality because that can help the district court judge below make a decision as to whether or not there's more information that needs to be turned over from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. And I would point, Your Honors, to the record where Judge Delaney indicates and invites counsel to make a more specific factual predicate so that she can decide whether or not we're going to need to go get those files personally and review them. Counsel declined on 2 separate occasions to make a more specific factual predicate. And based upon this record, there is no reason to find that the district court misunderstood the law under Brady or misapplied the law under Brady. I also believe, Your Honors, should continue with the case of Roberts. I think that that case has and will continue to show Brady material and inform the state of its obligations to provide that Brady material. I also urge Your Honors to follow the federal cases of Jennings and Herring that indicates the prosecutor is not required to go through those files personally because of, obviously, the sheer numbers of, that would involve. And based upon the record in this case, I urge Your Honors to affirm the conviction below. There wasn't evidence that wasn't turned over. There wasn't a showing of materiality. And without even being able to find how that evidence would have played into this case, the defendant can't show prejudice. And I believe, I think it was Justice Stiglitz below, I'm sorry if I get that wrong, but my understanding is one of the justices at the original hearing on this case asked, well, were the officers even the most important witness in this case? And I have to tell you, they were not. Part of the process in this case was having the witnesses come in and corroborate each other. But the most important witness was Kirsten Jackson, who testified about the actions of the defendant on March 14th and March 15th, 2014. She was the case. The first officer that testified came and said that, yeah, she had some injuries consistent with what she told us. The detective that came and testified said, yeah, she had some injuries consistent with what she told us. The crime scene analyst that came in and testified said, yeah, there was some evidence in the room that was consistent with what she told us. Over and above that, they provided nothing new into the record, including any statements by the defendant that would have prejudiced him with any additional disclosure of any evidence. So based upon the information provided and the way that this case has been pled, I ask that Your Honors affirm the conviction below. And unless you have any additional questions, I don't have any additional comments.
Can I ask you this? I have you here. Yes. A couple more questions. I think you still have time. A couple more questions. So if the department is the one who's essentially doing the sifting, and let's say, for instance, it is an excessive force. They're the material. They say, my defense is they're the first aggressor, and I think they've been aggressive. And the court says, hey. So you would, what type of information, like how would you satisfy yourself as the prosecutor who ultimately, if Metro gets it wrong, on the back end, it's your obligation. So how are you satisfied that there's a process within Metro that they know how to identify what is Brady? Maybe, are they too narrow in what they think is Brady? Are they broad enough? Like, how do you satisfy yourself, and how does that work?
Well, in the use of force context, I would be satisfied because they keep internal use of force reports, mm-hmm. which we are allowed to subpoena and provide, of course, if the case calls for it. Right. That wasn't an issue in this case, so I didn't request any use of force reports. There was no allegation.
More an abstract question.
Yeah. In the abstract, there is another avenue that I'm able to look into to see if the use of force was an issue. If, for example, we're talking about the officer in Milkey who went off the rails and had apparently been off the rails for many, many, many years, that information, I think most prosecutors would have talked about that around the water cooler, and we would have been able to look into that if that was an issue. I'm satisfied with this process because my understanding is we all have the same goal, justice for the defendant. That's the oath we took. That's the oath that's been pointed out in all the cases cited by the defendant. Justice for the defendant and justice for the people of the state of Nevada. I am satisfied that at Metro they have developed internal policies through the use of their lawyers that will determine if any information is Brady material and that they will provide that to us. The reason we run the check every time we announce ready for trial is because in the interim something could come up. So it's not just that we run it once and we're done. It's not just that we run it at the first trial setting and we're done. We have to run it at close in time to the trial as we can to make sure that we catch everything. I believe that those safeguards are in place, and I believe that those safeguards have worked, and I am satisfied with the policies and procedures that they have developed to make sure that I get what I need. If so, of course, there's another material issue raised by the defense, as you indicated, someone provides a very specific comment, I believe I have the ability to contact them and ask about those items specifically, and I would do so. And if there was an issue with that, we would bring it to the court's attention.
To that end, do you only focus on, is it only, the focus only sustained complaints or the complaints themselves?
I believe Ms. Lucich addressed this issue, and I think they also addressed this issue in some of the cases cited in our responsive brief to the NACJ. My understanding is it is after an investigation is completed, they have either determined that this indeed happened or they have determined that it was not. The reason that we ask for sustained violations is because in a town of 2 million people with many persons who are just angry for being pulled over or their neighbor called the cops on them and they're mad that the officer showed up, there are a lot of complaints that ultimately turn out to be not valid. And I believe that we are able to protect the defendant's due process rights by providing them only with the ones that have been sustained because they have been, of course, investigated. So that's the difference there.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honors. We ask that you affirm the conviction.
Thank you for giving me the additional time. I want to use it to talk about materiality. The notion, I think, that the duty of inquiry violation must be analyzed based on a failure of the duty to disclose evidence, I think, is foreclosed by the violation itself. In the materiality prejudice for suppressed Brady material, of course, the court looks at whether the evidence had it been disclosed, is there a reasonable probability that the result would have been different? The question in that regard is, does it undermine confidence in the verdict? What's involved in that kind of analysis is looking at the evidence that was suppressed and doing a quantitative analysis of that evidence and comparing it with the evidence that was offered at trial. But that's not possible here. The nature of the violation is that we don't know what evidence might have been uncovered. And it is conceptually impossible to quantitatively assess evidence that doesn't exist because it was never looked for as a result of the violation at issue. So I think the notion that Mr. McMurray would have to demonstrate prejudice somehow ignores that there will never be a finding of prejudice.
They said they looked. They did an inquiry, and there was nothing responsive. So what more are you looking for?
What they said is we will send our truthfulness inquiries.
Okay, and presumably they did. No, okay, reasonably right. They didn't. And they came back without a truthfulness.
Truthfulness inquiries, number one, are limited in scope, as you just discussed, and as the District Attorney's Association believes, it's too limited, it's too narrow, it's a rigid rule that only applies to sustained truthfulness violations when other issues, like incompetence or sloppy note-taking, might be relevant in a trial. So,
aren't you asking them to kind of be have a crystal ball there about what you're thinking? I mean, why wouldn't you say we think there's, you know, incompetence here? Make some sort of factual showing to kind of narrow down your request so they know what they're looking for.
Because it kind of asks a defendant to describe what's in the file before asking if it's in the file. I mean, I don't know, for example, in a DNA case, how would a defendant necessarily know that a crime scene analyst had been written up for sloppy evidence collection procedures? If that were an isolated incident and it weren't in the paper, how would a defense attorney know that? Out of the ether, he would have to somehow divine that there's an issue as to this evidence collector's competence. I just don't know where the information would come from to make that initial predicate showing. You know, more to the point, in a case like this, what if the detective who interviewed the alleged victim in this case had been reprimanded for destroying notes or for preparing reports that were inaccurate? In a case like this, where the defense to the most serious four counts, the sexual assault, was consent or reasonably mistaken consent, if the detective had noted during his interview that the alleged victim had said, for example, that the sex began consensually, that would be significant. That would bolster the defense in this case. If she told the sex assault nurse, well, yeah, initially it was consensual, but then I wanted to stop, that would have supported the defense at trial here, that it was either consensual or there was reasonably mistaken consent.
But what you're commenting about is exculpatory evidence. And this prosecutor would be putting her license on the line in a subsequent post-conviction if any of that was found to be the case. She said she looked for Brady, none. She did a truthfulness investigation, none. why shouldn't the court accept that representation?
I would say because it's inconsistent with what the prosecutor said to the court, which is, how am I supposed to learn of material evidence? Call every police officer at Metro? If it is as easy as making Brady request to Metro, this comment seems extremely out of place. And setting aside what the prosecutor said, the district court said the state is not required to go out and seek information within. Well, that's just completely contrary to what Kyle says. Kyle says the prosecution team must look inward for exculpatory information. So even if we're to take the prosecutor's assertions now at face value, that they did comply with their Brady obligation and their duty of inquiry, it still leaves outstanding some confusion, apparently, by the district court about whether prosecutors have such a duty.
But looking at Sonner, I'm having trouble getting past that. Tell me why that doesn't take care of this issue.
Sure.
As far as demonstrating materiality.
Sure. Two reasons. Number one, Sonner involved a request for full disclosure of personnel records of a victim. In this case, all that was requested was limited disclosure of information affecting witness credibility of a witness.
But still, the bigger picture was materiality and not wanting to get have these courts allow fishing expeditions.
And that's, I agree.
That's kind of the theme here.
I agree. Sonner has that materiality language in it. I would just say that it occurs within the context of a broad request that the defense attorney get all of the personnel records.
Well, where does it say that?
No, I'm saying Sonner says that's not acceptable. You have to make an initial showing of materiality before you get what you're asking for, which is full disclosure. It doesn't go so far as to say you have to make an initial showing of materiality before you're entitled to impeachment evidence in these personnel files. I think disclosure of that is compelled by Giglia. And I think the state, to some extent, acknowledges that they have a duty to look for this kind of information in personnel files because they do send these truthfulness requests.
Counsel, give us your closing thought.
I would just, you know, I won't belabor anything I've already said. I would just ask that this conviction be vacated. I would say with a constitutional violation like this, it is the state's burden to prove that it was harmless. And the state cannot prove that this constitutional violation was harmless because it cannot quantify the harm that resulted from its refusal to simply learn if law enforcement in fact possessed exculpatory evidence. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Court thanks counsel both sides for illuminating the issues presented in this case. This matter will stand submitted. We are